Hello and welcome to the Last in the Present series of What We Just Watched. My name is Graham.
And I'm Ian. And today we're going to start with Graham's choice of programme.
Ian, this programme I'm going to show you begins with what I've latterly come to know as a cold opening, but I think probably I would have referred to it as a pre-credits sting or something before.
Fine.
And it's quite long, it's a few minutes, but I thought it might be fun to have you sit and watch the whole of the cold opening before we hit the opening titles and see where you actually twig what's going on or what it is that we're watching.
Right, okay.
Let's start.
Okay, well, that's the current BBC logo, so it must be not too far back.
And what are you seeing on screen here?
We're going through someone's garden, isn't it? It was creeping through a garden up to a camera. We're behind a camera, going through the lens.
Any thoughts? What genre?
Well, is it some sort of like a? Oh, we're hearing some speaking now.
I'm trying to get it focused.
Is it a drama then of some kind? Out there. Oh, wait a minute. I think I recognise who those two people are. Is that Reeves and Mortimer?
Yes, it is.
So is this when they did Randall and Hopkirk? Is that what it is?
Yes, this is the 2000 revival of Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. And actually, you got there very quickly. So let's go away and watch this episode. We've just watched the first episode of the remake of Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, which aired on BBC One on 18th of March 2000. How does it work for you, Ian, as a series opener?
It doesn't.
Now, can you expand upon that? Why doesn't it?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. It's too long.
Yeah. Too long?
Yeah.
You don't think it should be an hour format?
No, I think that could easily have been compressed to half an hour.
Okay.
And they could have killed him off before the opening titles.
Okay.
It doesn't work as either a comic drama or a sort of bit of fantasy drama or a murder mystery. It doesn't work on any score, I don't think. And also, it's been a while since I've seen such a poor collection of badly acted performances from an otherwise prestigious cast.
Okay, so let's go back a little and establish some details about the show. I suppose now one would refer to Charlie Higson as being the showrunner, although that was a term we hadn't heard in 2000. But he writes every episode of this first series of Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, albeit one he co-writes with Paul Whitehouse. And he was brought in once the production company had acquired the rights for the show and they'd cast Reeves and Mortimer as Randall and Hopkirk. And Reeves and Mortimer, my understanding is, then suggested Charlie as a writer. Simon Wright, who is the executive producer, he always knew that he wanted to have a comedian in the role of Marty Hopkirk, as in the deceased.
Really?
He had suggested Robbie Coltrane.
"Ach, Billy, you great lump," she says. "Pearls for your clothes. You can't use it in the dishes."
Or Rick Mayall.
"I don't know if you're like me, immensely rich, talented, handsome. Isn't it a bore?"
Would you have preferred to see either of those?
No. So, I think that is the first of the sort of the key flaws here. The idea of casting a comedian in a dramatic role.
And why? Because it has worked in other instances, hasn't it? I mean, Rick Mayall was a set. Well, he appeared in a couple of Jonathan Creek episodes.
"It's dangerous stuff, petrol. When I got my lads to search your car this morning, I couldn't quite work out what it was doing there, so I had them replace it with diluted apple juice."
But the format of Jonathan Creek was well established before Mayall came in. And that was a programme that had a very clear identity from the start, I think. Whereas this, I can't get any hook on what the identity is of this programme.
Yes.
"I hear the sound, boom, 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 of distant drums, bum bum bum, bum bum bum."
Robbie Coltrane was cast in Cracker.
"Some killers rely on the flimsiest of excuses for the most heinous crimes."
And that seems to work, but do you think, again, that's because maybe the starting point is that this is a drama?
Yeah, that knew exactly what it wanted to be from the off.
Yeah, so you feel that there is something
There's something really fundamental that's missing from this, and that is the basic premise of what this program is meant to be.
You told me that you'd never watched it. What time do you think it went out?
It's an odd one because the episode is quite grisly in places.
Yeah.
So I can't think it must have been on much before 8 p.m.
Are you going pre or post Casualty?
Well, hang on, because if Casualty was on round about that sort of time, 8 p.m., then maybe this was after Casualty then. Is that when it was?
It was. It was at 5 to 9. Ooh. And I wonder if that's part of the reason for the uncertain tone. I feel like perhaps there is a pitch document that says it's kind of an adult fantasy drama or a...
that makes it sound rather seedy.
Well, it does. So I don't mean it like that. A grown-up's one.
But for adults.
For adults. Because I think perhaps the problem is it never feels that it commits to its premise, that it's always slightly ironic and postmodern.
But it feels, it feels cartoonish when it's not meant to be.
Marty! You beauty! You didn't really think I'd leave you, did you, partner? You took your time, didn't you? Yeehaw!
And... too grisly. When it's not meant to be grisly in those scenes,
yes,
either.
Yes.
So it seesaws between these two extremes.
Something that surprised me watching this back, and it's maybe the first time I've watched it since it was broadcast, is that Tom Baker doesn't appear in this opening episode. Now, did you remember he was part of the series at all?
Is he in it?
Yep, he's a regular in the series.
Who is he?
My name is Tom Baker, and I play Wyvern. A benevolent ghost, a sort of tutor to the dead at the level of limbo.
So there is an element which I suppose is the thing which Charlie Higson has developed about Randall and Hopkirk, which is that we actually see what happens to Hopkirk in the afterlife, and Tom Baker plays his kind of guide.
Oh.
So you've forgotten that completely.
Well, I told you I never watched it.
Yeah.
I read about it at the time, but all of this is news to me.
And what's your response then when you hear... I mean, because Tom Baker is very much brought into play Tom Baker.
Yeah, well, who else does he play nowadays?
But what's it say to you about what they were doing with this show?
Well, they were trying to appeal to a very particular audience, aren't they? The Doctor Who audience. This is really interesting, isn't it? Because you've got a programme that's kind of groping towards an audience that... perhaps it thinks is there somewhere that remembers Doctor Who on Saturday nights, wants some sort of action, adventure, fantasy thing.
Yes.
But can't quite get all the elements in line and can't cast it. I mean, David Tennant's in this as well. That's another interesting...
That's just purely coincidence, but yes,
coincidence, yeah. And Murray Gold is the...
he does the incidental music.
Musician, yeah. So there's sort of... It's scrambling towards something.
So it's kind
of... can't quite get the pieces in place.
It makes me think that it's the cocktail that they're putting together here is Reeves and Mortimer, so edgy kind of comedy that's appealing to an audience that is now probably getting into their 20s or 30s.
Yeah.
Tom Baker, so that's a nostalgic yearning for the same audience, thinking, oh, I used to love it on Saturday nights when we would have, you know, Doctor Who. And so it's sort of like saying, well, we've made a new one, which is especially for you now you've grown up, but now with its tongue-in-cheek as well.
No, yeah, I mean, that's... oh, God, it's so knowing.
Yes.
And you can't do that with this sort of programme because it immediately sets up all these barriers between you and the programme. You can't take it at face value. You can't take it seriously. You know that everything that happens is being done with a slight raised eyebrow.
Yes.
So why should you bother feeling anything particularly warm towards it?
And there is a very on-the-nose gag. Did you notice it with when David Tennant's character comes in to visit them in their office?
Is that a painting?
He talks about the poorly painted skyscape backdrop that they have outside the windows.
It's not very good.
Now that is a kind of a homage but piss take of ITC production values.
You don't want that. Don't ever do that in one of these programmes.
No.
You can't parody a parody. Don't layer onto something that's already a parody of an adventure series other in-jokes and spoofs and homages, because they don't work.
And that's a very good point, isn't it? Because one could say the original Randall and Hopkirk, the whole point of that was saying, let's take the usual detective series and give it a twist. And then what this is doing is, let's take a twisted detective series and give it another twist.
Oh, yeah. So it you end up spinning round and round. Okay. You just get all giddy.
Hello, Jeff.
What?
Marty, you're not dead!
course I'm dead, you idiot. You buried me. I keep trying to tell you I'm a ghost.
Stop it, Marty. It's not funny.
I know it's not funny. I'm a flaming stiff, but will you please listen to me? Bloody hell.
The defining thing about this is the casting of Vic and Bob. Now, is that the programme's triumph? Is that its point of difference? Or is that its vulnerability?
Well, it's certainly not a triumph. Neither of them are good actors. They seem to be unsure about how to play any of their scenes,
yeah.
Whether they should do it in kind of broad comedy,
yeah.
Or whether they should try and go for more sort of realistic emotional stuff. Neither of them work, or neither of the actors deliver good performances either, I think. Although Bob Mortimer is probably worse because he has to try and appear all emotional and grief-stricken.
Yes.
I never thought I'd say this, Marty, but I'm gonna miss you. So long, then, partner. Enjoy yourself wherever it is you're going.
He can't take it seriously.
I mean, the problem with Bob, so we should say, okay, so Bob is playing Jeff Randall and Vic is Marty yeah. Hopka. And you can see that kind of makes sense because Vic is the bigger character out of the two of them anyway, so to turn him into the ghost, that seems the obvious way to go. Bob's character, he just seems a bit of a drip.
He's very bland.
Yes, and he's not...
You can't feel anything for him.
He's not much of a protagonist, and I don't know whether it's... I don't know if it is his performance or the writing that's letting him down. He's kind of mooning around after Jeannie all the time and uses her name almost at the start of every sentence.
Jeannie, please just stop the car!
Jeannie, there's the photographer.
Jeannie.
I'm sorry, Jeannie. Where?
Thanks, Jeannie.
No, Jeannie.
Jeannie, get out! Get out, Jeannie! Come on, quickly, Jeannie!
You can't invest anything into Bob's character because he doesn't reward you with anything in return.
No.
You don't feel that you're getting any payback from investing stuff into him because he doesn't deliver.
No, there's no direction to what he's doing. And I think even though you talk about it's a very good cast, people like Charles Dance and yeah. Amelia Fox plays Jeannie.
Look at the cast list. I think, it's a prestigious lineup here.
Yeah. And so it's laden down with talent and none of them are really able to do their best work. Although you can still see that there is a sense of purpose when Amelia Fox is delivering her lines.
Excuse me.
What?
Do you mind not hitting my fiancé?
Or Charles Dance.
Fiancé? You can't possibly walk down the aisle with this little turd, let alone bear his children.
And then there's a sense of inertia, I feel, when Vic or Bob are doing their bits. So it must have been a weird atmosphere on set whereby... You've got actors who are getting nothing back from their two leads. It's sort of they're a bit of a vacuum, I think.
Yes, and possibly because of that, the guests and the supporting actors are having to feel, right, oh, I better overcompensate.
Yeah.
I think that's just true of David Tennant in particular.
Yeah.
The bitch is back!
He is way over the top.
We'd be finished, but my art lives on. Man and art! Indistinguishable. I am immortal.
Please. Perhaps because he senses he's getting such a poor and very sort of empty performance from the two leads, so yeah. He's got to make up for it.
So no one in this kind of a show, a returnable show where you have, well, I suppose one would say it's three leads really with Vic, Bob, and Amelia. No one is setting a tone, so it feels like people show up and don't know where we're going with any of this.
Yeah.
And in a similar vein, over this first series, it brings in a lot of kind of heavyweight talent, a lot from the world of comedy. So there are people like Hugh Laurie, Simon Pegg. We saw in this episode as well, Mark Gatiss, Steve Pemberton. We saw Charles Dance. Matt Lucas will appear. David Walliams, Rhys Shearsmith, Martin Clunes. Derek Jacobi.
Oh, they're all men as well.
Well, that's true, but is this that's a valid approach, isn't it? A Saturday night show, so you want to pack it with a big star each
yes,
episode.
Yes, you would imagine, and tonight's guest star. It's that old style of the old action-adventure series, yeah. Tonight's guest star, Derek Jacobi.
Or, alternatively, it's Morecambe and Wise as well, isn't it? Of having a guest star in who one would imagine they're told, oh no, come along, and you'll have a lovely, a smashing time, because we'll give you a really big character, you'll get to do stuff you don't normally do. In shows, you can be a bit over the top. Do you think that's part of it as well?
Maybe, but I mean, imagine thinking that you're going to be doing something like Morecambe and Wise and then you show up with this.
It's kind of nice to watch a show where you think, well, here's Vic and Bob and here are the other comedy faces that we like to see around them. But alternatively, does it sometimes feel a bit like, oh, it is them now, and it would be them, that kind of cronyism, that, oh, okay, here they all come.
I felt that, especially when Gatiss and Thingamy appeared on screen. I thought, oh, here we go.
Thought you ought to know we've closed the case. Basically, she was just bonkers. Sorry, that was inappropriate.
Insane. She was insane.
And why did you think that?
Because it's all the in crowd, it's the mates.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, how unsurprising that they show up. This leads into something else, which we haven't touched on yet. If it is meant to be a comedy drama, where are the gags?
Yeah.
There are no jokes. I didn't laugh once the entire episode.
No.
And that was despite these supposed comic characters like these two detectives. Reeves and Mortimer are comedians.
Yeah.
I don't want to see them being all dour and glum and moody. I want to see them entertaining. I want to see them being funny. That's what they do.
I think then this show makes a lot of assumptions about its audience, in terms of the audience being on side, in terms of the audience wanting to see these characters. It does very little to kind of... Yeah. It makes the assumption that you're already excited about this concept, I feel.
Do you think it knows what its audience is, though? It's making assumptions about an audience.
Yeah.
But maybe not the audience that it actually wants. I don't think it even knows. It's sort of throwing all these elements together,
yeah,
in the hope that there will be an audience of some kind. And thinking, all right, on paper we've got Reeves and Mortimer, blah, 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 blah. Of course people are going to watch. That's what they're thinking. But I think that was wrong. I think they were wrong.
And Randall and Hopcock, even by this point, was a franchise that didn't have a lot of awareness. It's not kind of the Avengers where people know what the basic premise is. But I felt that this opening episode is underscored by this, again, another assumption that the audience is expecting Vic's character to die, and it plays with that.
You're a dead man.
And so we have all these kind of near misses for him and people saying very arch things, you know, like Amelia Fox does what Deb said to Andy in EastEnders, her last words to him.
Drop dead!
But he has all these kind of near misses. That game holds back the revelation or getting across what the central conceit of the whole series is. And as you said, you feel that they should maybe have just killed him in the pre-titles.
Yeah, and didn't just get on with the first of the mysteries. And he doesn't die until about halfway through this hour-long episode. And by that point, I was thinking, for God's sake, just die. Get on with it.
And when he does die, it's in a car which goes over a cliff. And the weird directorial choice is that the camera stays on his face and you're seeing this character who we're supposed to love. And you have to stay with him while he's realising he's about to lose his life. That feels... It's not something you really want to see in detail, is it?
No, especially as just moments before, he's been dangling off the side of the cliff, like Frank Spencer in Some Mothers Do Have Them.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, oh, it's going to be a bit of a wacky comedy death. And then seconds later...
How much of the problems here are writing problems, do you think? Because I think if I had to now give you a summary of that plot, what happens, I feel I'm a bit sketchy on some of the details. So, for example, we have David Tennant, who's an artist, and it turns out that actually his wife has been producing all his most acclaimed works. Charles Dance is his agent and is some way complicit in that. For some reason, they decide they're now going to kill his wife. She ends up in a car that's driving Vic over a cliff. But then it turns out that that was her body in the car. So who's driving that car, and why are there robot David Tennants? I mean, the whole thing has, I feel, with shows, and this probably was an issue with, you know, when Charlie Higson tried to bring Jekyll and Hyde to ITV as well, is that you never feel like you've got an idea of what the shape of an episode is. Maybe what I'm saying is it's supposed to set up certain expectations, which it then will pay off in the way that Jonathan Creek does. Here's a mystery, here's a side mystery, and by the end, they're paid off. Here, I don't really get what the shape of, certainly in this pilot, what the shape of the episode is. Do you feel that as well?
Yeah, I agree. I as we were watching, I was noting down or trying to summarise what was happening. And in the end, I thought it was just more like a sequence of things, sensations, sounds, noises, ensembles, people shouting, people running about. And there is no sense at all of a narrative unfolding in a way which makes sense.
Yeah. We've talked about the uncertain tone, and I think the direction doesn't help sometimes, because at times it's quite sort of self-consciously avant-garde. Now, I don't know whether that's because this episode is about a kind of a Damien Hirst-style artist, but there are kind of fishbowl lenses, Dutch angles, there's an over-cranked party scene, there's the shots when Jeff is throwing the dirt down onto Marty's grave, where you sort of see the dirt coming down and it does this kind of cross-cut with Amelia Fox's eyes. There's a weird sort of art house element here, which I think, again, is it over-egging it? Is there too much irony in this mix?
I think, yeah, I think it's a bit of, okay, we need to overcompensate again for deficiencies elsewhere,
yeah,
by upping the quota of arty, flashy direction shots.
Yeah. The whole aesthetic I get from this is a sort of Select magazine. It's a kind of a middle-of-the-road indie aesthetic, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but Select from the mid-90s.
Yes, from the mid-90s.
So rather than the turn of the decade.
Which feels it, you know, in terms of these are the kind of comedians that Select magazine would probably cover in a kind of a poppy way.
Everything and then, feels slightly out of date.
And they have on yeah. the soundtrack, they have Pulp versus the Swingle Singers, who've done this song, this incredibly annoying song.
It's atrocious.
My body made diamonds, my heart will keep loving you, baby. Ooh.
That appears, but then that's also part of this. It's the safe end of the indie scene, isn't it?
Yeah, but again, it's a few years out of date. The whole aesthetic of it, that Damien Hirst character, the anoraks and bottles of lager, the sort of vaguely Britpop feel to it, and all those faces, all those characters and actors, and they all belong a few years ago.
Mm.
It's like TV; it always has this habit of being just a bit late to the latest.
Appropriates everything maybe 5 years too
yeah,
late.
Yeah, French and Saunders always used to do this, and when it comes around for when they did their parodies and spoofs, it's like, oh, I remember them. They're parodying that thing from a few years ago,
yeah.
And that dilutes its effectiveness and its impact because it's already out of date.
But talking about music, there is something about this show which is, I would say, completely successful.
You're talking about the signature tune,
yeah.
Then yes, definitely.
Yeah. No, this is David Arnold, and yeah. This is him in his full kind of Bondian flourish, isn't it?
This would have been around about the time that he was doing the scores for the Bond films, because he did Tomorrow Never Dies
yeah.
in 97, The World Is Not Enough in 99. So he was right at the peak of his Bond powers.
Yeah.
And this could easily have fitted into one of those films.
And there is no, I think it's quite interesting, there is nothing in that echoes back to the original Randall and Hopkirk theme, is there?
No.
No.
That's right, it's completely new, which is good.
I think it's a good choice because it's not the most memorable of things anyway, is it?
No.
At this point, I feel that the BBC, no, let's say mainstream kind of entertainment, had a newfound excitement about cult, about things that are culty. Maybe that, you know, what were the CD reissues? This Is Cult, was that the name of those, which was kind of old ITC tracks?
Yeah, that was certainly, this was the time when you were getting all of those compilations appearing, probably off the back of there was that run of years in the 90s when BBC Two
yeah
would show a load of old series on Friday evenings.
Yes, in a DAF 2 slot, wasn't
yep,
it?
Yep, and again, this kind of fits in with the slightly Britpoppy feel to this programme in the sort of bit of awareness of kind of kooky, quirky
quasi-60s as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know that I would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar.
Well, in terms of the fashions, as well as the music and that sort of easy listening fad that came back in for a time around the late 90s.
And I also think things like Quentin Tarantino films as well, which was cult and those kind of aesthetics.
Putting into the mainstream.
Yeah, just making big money.
Yes.
So it feels like this is what telly's doing. But it also feels like this is just before, and literally 2 or 3 years before, they rediscovered that there is a family audience, which is what they did with Doctor Who. This is, I mean, Jonathan Creek was always pitched at an older audience. They had a show called Strange that didn't last very long, which was a kind of, it was Richard Coyle.
What was that?
It was Richard Coyle, and I think it was written by Andrew Marshall. And it was just Quirky Investigator.
BBC was this?
Yeah, BBC. So I think this is before they knew that there is a general family audience. So what they're doing is, I mean, if Randall and Hopkirk was coming back now, that would be a family audience show, whereas this is saying, oh no, we don't think that audience exists, but we do think there is this, as we said, sort of later years hipsters.
That's it,
who just want a bit of fun.
Yeah, and hence that time slot after Casualty, too late for kids.
Yeah.
But I suppose also, an odd time, if you want to get that kind of crowd watching on a Saturday night, wouldn't they be out and about?
I think the theory is they're now just a bit too old to be out and about.
Oh, I see. Yes. So they've
started their own families, and so their little kids are in bed.
But they want something a little bit...
Yeah, hipster mum and dad now together on a Saturday night.
Oh, dear. What an image.
And this follows on from Vic and Bob having a tryout on Saturday nights anyway with Families at War, which was in 99.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Families at War. And on tonight's show, is this the best way to eat a cream cake?
There is this idea that the BBC is suddenly locked into these talents, and it has to keep throwing stuff at them before it's seemly to say, actually, do you know, things aren't working out. So we've tried you with an entertainment show. Let's give you a drama series now. Let's see how we get on with that.
Yeah, and again, that ended badly.
And here are your team captains, Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, with tonight's family.
Now, did you ever watch the original Randall and Hopkirk?
I didn't, but I tell you that if it ever did happen to come back, or I suddenly saw that there was an episode from the original on, I would probably tune in because of its appeal as a sort of historical curiosity.
Okay.
And I think that is the one thing that it does have going for it. The original series, mind you, not the remake.
So if you had to pick between Randall and Hopkirk 2000 and Randall and Hopkirk 60s?
Oh, 60s, definitely. Well, that was an episode of Randall Hopkirk Deceased. Now it's my turn to show Graham a surprise programme. This is one of those programmes whose opening titles will tell you nothing about what you're about to see.
Okay.
So, to that end, I think what I'll do is I'll just start it playing.
Yes.
Describe what you're seeing.
Yes.
It'll be very obvious what it is very quickly.
Okay.
Then I'll pause it and then I'll talk a little bit more about what we're about to see.
Okay.
Okay, so here we go.
Oh, so that's going to be a metronome, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm getting the vibe of a parlour game show. Oh, or is it a 40 minutes? Is this 40 minutes, the metronome? Yes, it is. Oh, look at that mixture of font. It's a kind of a tall, stretched Times New Roman 40 above a kind of a Block Sans minutes.
It's a lovely font. Now, before we go any further, what I thought I'd do is, because obviously that none the wiser
could be any
episode, about to see.
Yeah.
I will read you what it said in Radio Times about this episode.
Okay.
So imagine that you are settling down to watch this episode.
Yes.
And all you know about it is this.
Okay.
40 Minutes requests the pleasure of your company at party time. This week, nearly everyone is going to, or is giving, a party. Come along and enjoy the fun.
Now, is this a royal occasion? Surely that billing would say Right Royal, though, wouldn't it?
Would, yes.
No billing would not have Right Royal if they could have had Right Royal.
Yep.
So it's a party.
So what do you think we're about to see?
Well, everyone's having a party.
Yeah.
And it's not just a generic episode about parties. Is there a proper tie-in? Is there a big national
Well, what do
party?
You think?
Well, I think it's either a... it's not royal.
It's
not royal. It's not going to be a BBC birthday because they wouldn't have the temerity to suggest that everyone's having a party, would they?
That's true, yeah.
For sort of 50 years of BBC television service. Maybe like Live Aid? Is it people watching Live Aid or Band Aid?
So what you're leaning towards, an event.
An event, yeah.
Which we are going to see through the eyes of...
People holding parties to maybe watch the event on telly. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah?
Well, I won't give you an answer.
Okay.
Instead...
Let's push on.
Let's watch 40 Minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so that wasn't quite what you were expecting, was it, Graham?
No, I think you led me down a bit of a blind alley because it's not really a communal celebration, is it, that we follow in the show? It's just lots of parties.
It is a sequence of seven in total, which are related only by the fact that they are themed in some way.
Oh, they're all themed parties, with, I would say, a party with a dress code, except for maybe the last one.
Yeah, it's a collection of... parties that are out of the ordinary, which is, I suppose, the reason why we're seeing them. And it's presented in a way where we are almost at the party as kind of bystanders, aren't we?
Yes.
We are loitering
on the sidelines. We're kind of wallflowers, aren't we?
Yes, exactly, yeah. And we are just simply watching what's happening at these parties. Before we go any further, I think I will explain why I chose this particular edition of 40 Minutes. Firstly, I think because it's just such a fascinating collection of people and places and a really evocative of a particular period in time.
Yes.
But secondly, because I think this is a kind of documentary that you just don't see on television anymore.
Yes.
And it can be defined by a few qualities. Firstly, there's no narrator.
Correct, yes.
Secondly, there's nothing added in terms of incidental music to accentuate what we're seeing or to encourage us to think a certain way. It's not following one particular person's story.
No.
It is what I'd describe as variations on a theme.
Yes.
So the producer has just thought of an idea and said, okay, right, let's do something where we show X number of examples of this.
Yes, it's a very... It's not pointed, it doesn't come... It's not setting out a thesis, is it?
It's just, no argument. Here it is, and it's letting us to make up our own mind.
Yeah.
And finally, it's from a series, an overarching series, which is intended to be nothing more than a collection of one-offs.
Yes.
40 Minutes was not a documentary series about, I don't know, class or...
No.
Or gender or something like that. It was just simply every week... There'd be something different.
Yes.
You never knew what it was going to be. The only thing you knew was what I told you beforehand, was that it lasts 40 minutes long.
Yeah.
And that was always meant to be the point. So I think from against all those criteria, and I think this stands a really good example of that type of documentary making. And what I think I'm right in saying that it just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I think it doesn't exist because there's no high concept here. I like the idea of saying, well, let's just pick a loose theme and we'll send cameras along to things that tie in with that loose theme. And then we'll compile that together. And I don't know, maybe there is a thesis in here and it's just very subtly woven in. But well, I would err on the side that there probably isn't.
I think if any conclusions that do emerge organically and were not in the minds of the filmmakers before they set out.
That's a good point. This isn't... It's a weird thing in a way because I think it would make no claims to be a State of the Nation piece, but it is a State of the Nation piece.
Exactly, yeah. State of the Nation, perhaps sort of lowercase rather than capital S, capital N. We'll go through each of the parties individually, but before we do that, it's 40 minutes long, obviously.
Yes.
That was the whole point of why it was called 40 Minutes. The person who had the idea for creating the series, the BBC producer Will Wyatt, says that he deliberately picked that name to ensure that all the individual producers and directors didn't go over 40 minutes because he thought that was the ideal time for this kind of documentary.
Okay.
But did it hold your interest for 40 minutes?
It did, yes, it did, because I felt that... do you know how many parties there are?
Seven.
There's seven parties. So it did feel that as my attention was beginning to dissipate, it would then cut to something else. And I think there's a lot in his thesis about 40 minutes
being the ideal time.
And I also think that's a very canny move because I've been rereading Michael Gray's autobiography recently, and he talks about the fact that every producer that you ever deal with will always say that they need 10 more minutes in the show to do the subject justice. And I like this idea of actually setting out your store from the start. There's going to be no leeway on this, and I think it focuses the mind.
How soon through those 40 minutes did you realise what was going on?
Probably a little way in, because I trained my mind to look for some kind of organisational thread in this. And so the first party we see is a kind of, it's an ocean liner themed party.
Yes.
This is your captain speaking. The slight delay was because my wife had put a plate of cucumber on the cassette that I should have played 10 minutes ago.
And the second one is a teenage ball. And so they both felt kind of quasi high society. So initially I thought, is this going to be something about how the Toffs, or to use the phrase that we hear in the show, the Hooray Henrys, spend their recreational time. And I think maybe by the time we reach the third party, I just realised it's just about parties. And there's something about that, then you then kind of relax into it, don't you?
Right, yes. I was hoping that would you'd respond that way, yeah. And just think, okay, so that's what we're getting.
Yeah.
And then just sit back and just wait and see what we're going to get.
Some do have quite a strong narrative and they really hook you in, like the woman who lives in Kentish Town in a council flat.
Yes.
I won't go into it yet because presumably we're going to go through them.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a really strong narrative on that. And the last one has a very beautifully told, very subtly kind of narrative that just sort of creeps up.
It's really well put together, I think.
I really enjoyed it. That's excellent. One thing I should be saying. Yeah, I thought it was great.
We thought it might be rather fun to have a party and convert our house into a liner.
Right, let's go through these parties in sequence then. And start with the first, which I think you enjoyed the most of all of them.
Well, it's... I'm not sure I did.
Okay.
I think I enjoyed it a lot because it kind of sets the tone for what's happening.
Okay, well, what we see is... it's an elderly couple, though we never see her, we just see him.
Yes.
In a big house, detached house in Oxfordshire, and he's done up the entire house to look like an ocean liner.
Tonight's programme, people will walk up the gangplank into the house. They will be welcomed by the purser and handed a glass of sherry.
For no real reason.
No reason whatsoever, other than that, last year he turned his attic into Concord.
Yes.
And the previous year... he turned his house into the Orient Express.
This year, I thought, well, we've travelled over land by train, by air. How about the sea?
He's in very kind of advanced years. This is what keeps him going.
Oh, yeah. This is a retired couple, obviously quite moneyed, with a big circle of friends, all similarly well off.
Yes.
And his idea of spending his time is to clearly, spend days and days planning a party.
Yes.
Whereby he can convert his entire house into a liner.
Yes.
During the course of this evening, there's business going on inside the house where he pretends to be a captain.
And he's constantly making announcements.
This is your captain speaking. Your captain speaking. There are storm clouds ahead.
He's made himself a kind of a cockpit area, and he's put a lot of detail into that. And it's only to satisfy himself, because no one else gets a go up there.
No one sees this sort of, the crew, the cabin, or the deck of the ship, except him. And he's got like a full sound system and everything as well. But not just that, outside the house.
Yes, this is the best bit.
He's recruited these people to fling buckets of water at the windows.
That's when they get into choppy
when
water.
They're in a storm.
Yeah.
And then we see them going through an ice field.
Yes.
So if you could warn me if you see an iceberg, and I'll take appropriate action.
And these people wheel past the windows, these enormous fake
icebergs
isn't it?
Yeah.
Icebergs! 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 Icebergs!
And then at the end... the pièce de résistance, and a Statue of Liberty is wheeled into view.
Ladies and gentlemen, the news is that we have broken the record for transatlantic ocean crossing. We've regained the blue ribbon for Great Britain by 3.5 minutes.
And he announces that they've crossed the Atlantic in record time.
They've won the blue ribbon back from America. It is the most elaborate... idea for a party.
And the thing I like about it, I don't like parties. I like themed parties even less. I like fancy dress parties even less than theme parties.
Yes.
But I would quite like this party because, do you know what? His genius is that everyone who comes along, all they have to do really is sit and enjoy their dinner.
Yeah.
And the stuff is just going on around them. No one has to make a
no
twat of themselves
from them, is there?
Participating. Yes, you get to, you know, you have to shout when you see the iceberg. I wouldn't mind doing that. I think that's quite fun, isn't it?
And also, it looks like it's a really nice spread of food.
It does. They've got loads, loads and loads on the go. Everyone is rammed in there, though, aren't they? Elbow to elbow.
Well,
in this
is a theme that we will see throughout this documentary.
They pack them in, yeah.
Is that all of these parties have pulled in people from far and wide.
Do you think it's because they know the cameras are there?
Well, I think there's a bit of the songs of praise element to it. When, it's that. This, you know what's happening this Sunday? The camera's in, and so the church gets a record turnout.
Yes.
I think word's gone out, BBC are in. And so no invitation has been turned down for this one.
No.
The second party is a complete contrast. It's a teenager's ball.
Yes.
But for a very particular kind of teenager, isn't it?
Well, this is where we hear... the phrase for the first time.
They're all fairly standard Hooray Henrys.
This is public school,
yeah,
kids.
Yeah. Slightly elevated from the Sloan Ranger, aren't they? I think these are. They have a little more money,
yeah,
don't they?
Moneyed again. And they're going along to. It's a privately organised party.
Yes. Some of the notes I made watching this section were girls in ball gowns, boys in cummerbunds, everyone smoking,
yep,
but also brandishing teddy bears.
Oh,
kind of
God.
Bride's head.
It's so much a bride's head ethos to this, isn't
yes.
it? It's they've probably read it at school. They remember seeing the TV adaptation,
yeah, and they're thinking, when I get to that age, that's how I'm gonna be. So the kind
enormous
of Sebastian
clothes, flights. Enormous clothes, but these very, very pointedly bring along these teddy bears and soft toys.
Yes. By the end of the night, all the boys have their trousers off, don't they?
And yeah, they're leaping boxes around.
This kind of very contained vision of what debauchery might look like.
This is one segment where we don't actually hear much being said. All we really see are just shots of this ball and the people getting progressively rowdier, but also there's a lot of shots of people sitting on the floor.
I know,
it looks awful.
They're not very well appointed events,
and
are
they're
they?
Slumped all over the place, legs akimbo.
They're snogging. Is this
there's teenage snogging in that really fumbled off embarrassed way. People by the end look really pissed off.
And there's some people snogging under bright lights as well. They're clearly,
yes,
you know, it's time to go home now, but they're still getting stuck in there. Did you feel, we're being a bit more disparaging about this party.
Yes.
Were we invited to by the programme to be, or
well,
is that just us?
This is a question that I think comes to mind throughout this documentary. To what end are we being encouraged to draw a particular conclusion about what we're seeing, thanks to the stuff that we're seeing, the way it's been edited together, the way certain shots are framed. I think here it seems pretty self-evident that we're being led towards a particular conclusion about this party.
Which is disapproval, do you think?
Well, or just maybe sort of distaste. Or I don't think we're encouraged to disapprove them, more to just sort of perhaps look down at them.
And I suppose, unlike some of the other parties, this really lingers to the fag end of the night, doesn't it? Where you
That's
see
true,
the
yes.
kind of the aftermath and all the
yeah.
cigarette butts in the carpet.
Because we don't see the cleaning up of any of the, or the sort of the dregs.
No.
Whereas this one, it's almost as if, well, the aftermath is just as much a part of the experience as the night itself.
Mm.
We have square dance parties because, to start with, they're so much fun. And also we get a bit of practice in. Usually whoever hosts them provides the drinks and then we all take some food.
The third party is a square dance party.
Yes.
A big shift, again, in tone, because we're now in a suburban living room.
Yes. And actually we're starting at the guest's house, aren't
oh, that's
we,
right,
before
yes.
they head out.
We see two people getting ready to go and join their friends
and
at
she's
the square dance party.
Taking some goodies, which includes, I noticed, a packet of cracker wheat.
Well, there's... All throughout this, there's lots of little traces of sort of consumer items and the sort of the chintz of everyday life.
Yes.
At one point, she's stuffing a frilly dress into an enormous Sainsbury's carrier bag.
That's right.
And then before they arrive at the location of the party, we see the owners of the house, clearing away all these items.
We've had quite a lot of square dance parties in the house. There's quite a lot of work involved, of course, which we don't mind, but it does mean clearing out the lounge completely.
Right, these parts have got to be moved.
And there's all this tat.
Doilies.
And these ornaments that don't look like anything. Mm. Enormous potted palms. Armchairs covered in those flowery casings.
Do you remember the name of the people who are holding the square doll?
Tonight's party is at John's and Joyce Deadman's in Goring.
That's like a Victoria Woods sketch. That's too on the nose,
well,
isn't it?
Well, you know what? During this segment, I couldn't help but thinking of those spoofs that Victoria Wood did of Fly on the Wall documentaries.
Well, I think I thought, why me sort of thing. Not really Charlton Heston sort of material. Apart from one of my thumbs being double-jointed, I'm really a fairly ordinary man.
And this is the closest we get to that.
It is, yeah.
Because we see a bunch of, well, how shall we refer to them?
They're
kindly?
Quite middle-aged, unattractive. Yes, yeah, they are eccentric.
Harmlessly eccentric.
Yeah.
But they do have their quirks and foibles.
But they, I mean, I use the term wallflowers in terms of how we were posited as viewers. But these are people that in another social setting would be the wallflowers.
They wouldn't know how to mingle.
They're the offcuts.
Anything with anyone other than like-minded souls.
It's a long battery hair, so we're happy on that score.
They've been keeping you busy though, haven't they?
Oh, yes, it came up a bit, but
I suppose it's nice that they have this place that they can come and get and do their square dancing.
And when people arrive at the house, someone has brought a whole melon, which I think is nice.
There's lots of kissing on cheeks.
There is
when they come in.
Arched doors they come through, porthole windows, and it's a barometer as well.
Oh, it's so suburban.
All the accoutrements, isn't it, that say that you're living comfortably.
And I loved how in this segment we would hear snatches of small talk between them. At one point we hear, she's got this virus. And we also hear, keeping you busy. all this sort of the elements of a suburban party.
But I found the sequence warming, and because there's a charming... So the gentleman that we follow from his house to their house with his wife, we see him at the start brushing his hair down, and there's this little tuft at the back.
That he's missed.
He's missed. And he's sort of got these NHS specs, and there's a heartbreaking moment, isn't there, where we see everyone chatting and the camera kind of gradually pans around. He's just stood there. No one's talking to him.
Yeah, he's got that sort of fixed smile on his face, looking a bit awkward.
Yeah.
But...
Sides go eight to the middle, then they come along back.
Then you see him doing the square dance, and everyone's having a lovely time. Yes. I find it genuinely charming and nice.
And it ends on a really lovely note where we're in the kitchen and the oven pings.
Yes, that's right.
And Joyce goes through to the kitchen, and from out of the oven she pulls this wonderful, enormous tray of
sausage rolls.
Yeah.
And they look lovely. Puff pastry sausage
and
rolls.
And we see her disappearing back into the kitchen and going, sausage rolls! We fade from that to the fourth party. Again, another shift in tone. And this is a... what is it? It's a party to launch a new studio, a new fashion studio by some young designers.
And I didn't quite pick up who out of all these were the designers, did you?
That wasn't made clear, and this was the segment I think I got least from.
Yeah,
because
me too.
All we really saw here were endless shots of the Hooray Henrys again.
Again, the standard Hooray Henrys
mingling.
Yeah.
Very close together.
Yeah. And drinking, they had kind of snow-themed cocktails, although the food looked great, didn't it?
Well, this is, it's a big step up, really, from the nautical party.
Yes.
Where we had a lot of food there, but it was what you'd expect, it was sort of pineapple on sticks food, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas here, we've got some very elaborate nibbles.
Very ethnic, and some oriental nibbles. And
yes.
These are breasts of pigeon and duck. And grouse and quail, all in tiny little parcels with little bows on. And those are Chinese fish balls that look like snowballs. I thought miniature Christmas snowballs, but in fact they're fish.
Yes, it's what they're calling a wrapped-up party, isn't
yes.
it? Because one of the designers says that she's got into themed parties, and she did one where that was all about sort of a descent into decadence.
Yes.
It was another one. And so because of this... they've hired in a man to stand almost naked, dressed as like a living statue.
Yeah.
There's a very camp pianist. There's some tomfoolery with some fake snowflakes. It feels, I've written down here, it feels very much like a sort of party that Jan Howard would throw to launch her latest range of clothes.
Yes, or come down the stairs maybe an hour into it, no one's seen her, and then she arrives wearing something amazing.
Well, she's been upstairs fretting about, I just don't know what to wear.
And she's also had to do some business calls.
Yes, yeah. She has some trouble with some workmen,
yes,
who are meant to get this studio finished on, yeah, time. She's been fretting, and then she decides to pull it all together to come down the stairs. And then...
and maybe there's a ripple of Simon May's theme on the piano as she's... Yes. Just coincidentally, the pianist, yes, decides to vamp that kind of a tune.
The scene then dissolves to the next party...
Which is in Cheshire. That's the first northern...
Yeah. And we're greeted by the sound... Oh, dear. ...of a string quartet playing really out of tune.
Yes, everyone's slightly out of tune in a different way, aren't they?
This is a musical party.
Yeah.
A kind of sort of musical soiree, really. But it's been done a little bit on the cheap.
Yes, it's by a young lady called Helen, isn't it? Who's got a bizarre accent. She fancies herself a little bit, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's got pretensions.
Yeah.
The musical party was really all my idea, because I really like parties anyway.
And we hear from her mum, who is clearly her...
She's loyally supportive, only up to a point.
But her mum would rather be doing poetry parties, but Helen doesn't like them, so they have to be musical parties.
Yeah.
So poor mum just has to kind of...
She's in the kitchen making this huge cake.
And she, you know, there is a little bit of aggression towards Helen. She at one point says that her daughter...
Exhibits herself a bit.
Very sort of underhand...
Yeah.
Mixed praise there, isn't it?
Well, it's like Helen is exhibiting her taste in high culture to the village, isn't she?
She's trying to educate the masses.
Yeah.
But she hasn't really made it very welcoming for them, because most of them have to sit on the floor.
Again. And do you think all through the night, just as people start chatting, there's a clap in the corner as she commands everyone looks at her again for another announcement?
Yeah, and everyone thinks,
fucking hell,
okay. Here we go again.
And she does this recital, doesn't she?
Angels.
She sets this up as saying, it's been 100 years ago, Liszt died. He didn't get a proper requiem, but I'm going to give him one now. And then she sings this very florid song, accompanied by Mabel on the piano.
Yes.
It's about 95.
And it sounds like a pub piano as well, doesn't it?
It's been wheeled in for the evening. And she has that way of singing, which, I mean, she's got the posture right and she's got the diction right, but there's just something about the
enunciation.
Yeah, and it's too forced.
Because I think she can hold a tune.
She can hold a note,
but she can't enunciate.
She can't project, and you can imagine sitting there and thinking, oh my God, what is this?
Yeah.
And everyone's got a forced smile on their face. Now, party number 6, the penultimate party.
This one made me anxious.
Yeah, this is the one where we actually have a bit of a narrative going on, because a woman in a council flat in Kentish Town...
Name is Maxine.
Maxine is having her first, she says her all-night party.
Mm.
And her intention is honourable, because she wants to introduce her circle of friends to those of who we assume is her partner, Chris.
I already think Chris is a ne'er-do-well, isn't he?
Well, you see, the tone of this is set right from the start, because the very first thing we see is not her getting her flat ready, but him in the pub getting all boozed up.
With all his biker pals.
With his biker friends, and immediately think, oh no.
In heavy metal t-shirts.
Oh no.
And she is clearly a single mum, and she's had to pack her kids off, isn't she?
It's really, well, it's quite telling that, you see her It's quite a small council flat. Yeah. It's not in the best condition.
At one point, she walks into a room and you can see just the shadow of the lampshade above her
head. There's no other furnishings.
You know, rocking because it's so small that she's clearly hit it on her
way. And she goes around, I mean, she's doing her best. She goes around taking all her valuables
all the
away.
Yeah.
I get on very well with nearly everyone who lives in this particular block. And I wouldn't like that relationship to end in any way as a result of the party. So that, I've got slight misgivings, but provided no damage is done to council property, then it's all right. I'm hoping that this one, my first, won't be my last.
Video cassettes are put in a dustbin bag.
Yeah.
She shoves them in a side room, along with the goldfish and the cat.
Well, that's a really heartbreaking moment, in the because we don't know that the cat's in there, but in the middle of this party, in the middle of the tumult, she goes into this room
to check everything's okay. And
yeah,
inside,
the cat's a frightened cat.
And the cat's carrying behind the goldfish tank.
Yeah, it's a sad moment. So Chris's pals all show up, don't they?
Well, I mean, you know how this one's going to go.
And she's had opprobrium from her neighbours and friends who are saying, no, don't bring them here.
Yeah, we don't want to see them. It's like people queuing for the doctors. It's like a whole snake of people queuing right down the stairs of the estate and out to get into this tiny flat. And once they're in there, no one can move anywhere.
I know, they're packed in. They're literally on top of each other in some points, but all chugging these kind of big cans.
This is just going to be really easy to move around.
We're going to move our party outfits and we'll remain in the kitchen.
Awful.
There's a couple of men in the kitchen. I'm like, they have no business being there, and they've clearly both got four bottles of wine, which they're chugging, which
they're
I bet you they're not theirs.
No.
They're for everyone, and they've just gone in there chugging them. They're doing thumbs up to camera.
Oh, yeah, and this is the one segment where we actually see people playing up to cameras. Mm. We see them doing that, which is what always happens when you introduce a camera to a rowdy, beery segment.
Well, exactly, and every time we see Maxine, she's having to firefight some other situation, isn't she, through this crowd.
Yeah, you feel so sorry for her, and she kind of has that stoical grin. Oh, here we go. And then at the very end, we see her outside with a friend.
The reason for this party was so that I could meet Chris's friends and he could meet mine.
You'll never turn up.
But mine never turned up, because as far as they're concerned, I've lowered myself and I'm a bad example to my kids.
And they're sort of commiserating on how all of his friends turned up.
None of hers. And she uses the phrase that she's lowered herself for this event.
I know.
And none of her friends showed up to support her. It's really, really, really sad. And I think, do you think in that block, people still talk now of that party?
Oh, the party.
Yeah, do you remember Maxine's party they'll talk about? Do you think whenever there's any kind of brouhaha in that block, someone goes, oh, Maxine's party all over again?
Yeah, oh, it's that, yeah, that time. Yeah. That party ends on a very melancholic note.
Yes.
And I think that's deliberate, because we then go into the final party of the programme, which is also tinged with melancholy and a bit of sadness because...
You knew Susie like I know Susie. What a gal.
Well, it's not immediately evident what we're seeing, is it?
No, at first I thought it was another country house party, because that's what we see, is a country house. And initially it looks like it's another kind of posh home counties thing. The next thing we see is this sort of very expressive troupe doing a kind of a musical sort of numbers.
It's a medley of old time musical.
And it performed by some youngsters quite exuberantly, very clean cut. And you think, oh, this is going to be, this probably is some kind of variety group or something like that doing their showcase.
Yes, but at that point I paused it and asked you, who do you think is watching this?
Which actually made the penny drop, because I think at that stage they're starting to do some kind of wartime standards.
Yes.
And then I twigged, this is a performance for an old folks home.
It is, yeah.
And the camera then is showing us these old folks, some very impassive, some not so, watching this entertainment. It's quite, I mean, it's reasonable entertainment, isn't it?
It's a
good fist of it.
And that is really all you see for the rest of this section, and indeed the programme, because we just get a series of shots showing how these people are responding or reacting, sometimes in a very subtle way, sometimes not at all, to what they're hearing And the effect is really quite moving.
And in some cases, you can see some of the older people who may be more confused and immobile have staff with them who are just have an arm around them or just really gently kind of coaxing them or helping them. There's one woman who kisses the old lady that she's looking after. It's really sweet. There's another old man who's almost catatonic, but you can actually see his mouth change into a smile.
This is a wonderful moment where you see a trace of response of recognition from him, and you think, oh yes, this music is getting through and therefore is doing its job.
And they hand out hankies, don't they, so that they can all wave them towards
in a particular song. And then at the end of one of them uses the handkerchief to dab their face because you can tell they've been moved to tears. I mean, it's very sad.
And partway through it as well, and I don't think they were doing it with any kind of comment, but they sort of cut to a sequence down the hall where other people, I guess, who just don't want to be there, are sat in a hall and they can hear the music sort of, you know, creeping through towards them. But they're not, you know, they're not responding. And then I think it was the old chap that we see who is moved to tears. I think we see shots of his bedroom because we see these wartime photos of this young man who I think was the same person.
So that gives another twist on what we're hearing in terms of the songs.
Yeah.
But yes, you see these shots of people staring, some of them to the middle distance, so you're not sure whether anything's getting through. But you can't help but feel... you feel heartened, I think, from what you're seeing, because it's so well-intentioned.
It's very loving, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. There's no cynicism or scepticism on display whatsoever. The music that's being performed is all being doing is entirely sincerely, is a good show, and everyone there you see is sort of doing their best to enjoy it, and we see them. Some are actually moved to get up and sort of move along in time. Mm. Some actually start to join in as well. And that's the point at which the credits start to roll and the whole thing comes to an end.
Mm.
One thing I've yet to reveal, Graham, is when this programme was broadcast.
Yes.
And I've done that deliberately because I wanted to see if you can guess when it was shown. I think we've talked pretty much about the decade.
We know it's the
80s. Yes. Yeah. When precisely in the 80s do you think this went out?
Well, I was erring towards 82, 83, and then at the square dance sequence, I saw that they had some kind of diploma for square dancing from 1984, so I wouldn't have put it any later than that.
What makes you think it's the early 80s, then?
Always just the quality of the film, in a way. It's very grainy, and I don't know, it's kind of... Now, why do I think that? Why do I think that?
Is it also the fashions that we see and the clutter we see in the homes?
It might be in part the fashions as well. This feels very new romantic in terms of the Hooray Henrys. That's kind of where they're going, puffball skirts,
big.
I mean, both men and women have Lady Di haircuts.
That's
It's that kind of thing, dire straitsy sort of music. I think that's... I mean, I would say... pre-Live Aid. I mentioned Live Aid at the start, pre-Live Aid.
Right. Well, it was actually December 1987.
Wow, okay. Which, it's... Wow. Yeah, because it could easily have been 82.
I think this is one of the real fascinating things about this, is the way that it is a time capsule of a particular era and is so redolent of the way people lived their lives during the 80s, or also how they spent their free time.
Yes.
Did this programme benefit from not having a narrator?
Yes, I think it did, because I think if there is a narrator, then it does push your mind towards thinking that there is a narrative. And there isn't a narrative. And once you accept that, then I feel the programme can get its clutches into you and you're more vulnerable to where it wants to take you. And so if there was, you know, you can imagine when it got to the old folks home, if we weren't making those realizations ourselves, a narrator would have said, at such and such old folks home, they've all assembled today for
it's entirely superfluous as well,
completely.
Isn't it?
So instead we make those realizations, and when they come to you, it's like a plot twist in a way, isn't
that's
it?
True, yes.
In this episode, we've watched Randall and Hopkirk, deceased from 2000, and 40 Minutes from 1987. And I think both kind of tell us quite a lot about when they were made.
I think that's true. But by accident, Randall and Hopkirk, deceased, tells us how out of step television had become round about the year 2000.
With the mainstream audience.
With audiences, yes. Both in how it looked and also the kind of audience that was out there. With 40 Minutes, we saw how out of step the real world had become with the world that, in retrospect, we're encouraged to think the 80s, the late 80s was all about, which was lots of snazzy technology and people looking...
Consumerism.
Consumerism, of course, the Big Bang, that whole sort of loads of money riff. Whereas, in fact, the country was lagging behind and would take a few years to catch up with where we were being told we should be.
Yes, because we're going into houses here and we're seeing black and white TVs, we're seeing vinyl records still being used.
Yes.
Not a CD player in sight at the moment, but people are probably saving up for those.
Yes, that's true. It's a very intriguing snapshot of how perceptions of the real world can fall out of step, out of sync almost, with what is actually going on.
You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched the first episode of Randall and Hopkirk Deceased from 18th of March 2000,
and an edition of 40 Minutes, which was shown on the 17th of December 1987. So until the next time,
goodbye.
Just like you.